In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. Hail Mary, full of grace, the Lord is with thee. Blessed art thou amongst women, and blessed is the fruit of thy womb, Jesus. In the name of the Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Spirit. We have to say very honestly and openly that the 14th century was a very bad time for the church. Some people with good intention, with every bit of good intention nowadays, have the position of saying that we are close to the end of times because of all the scandals and problems in the church, and because of the sinful ways of the world and all that is happening in nature. Well, we don't know. That might be the case. But I suppose if we attend to the facts, probably there have been at least two or three other periods in the church, maybe four, perhaps five, very difficult times, times in which, with every right, a normal, regular Christian could have thought, this is the end of the world. I suppose it is healthy to remember this. You remember the end of the Roman Empire. There is a glimpse of that period in the great book of St. Augustine, The City of God. The City of God was written in the context of the, really the fall, the big fall and destruction of the Roman Empire. What Augustine, being himself in the last leg of his own life, what he saw, what he had before his eyes at that time, that's the beginning of the fifth century. What he had in front of his eyes was the corruption and destruction, the collapse of the Roman Empire. And that very much seemed like the end of the world, because, you know, the Romans have sold very well the idea that Rome is, well, eternal. So if you see the eternal city being defiled and destroyed by very rude and merciless people, you have the impression this is the end of the world. And actually, so much progress that had been achieved by the Romans was kind of buried after that, and we have to wait many centuries till humankind recovers that level of culture. And then you have, by the end of the first millennium, it was called that 10th century was called the Iron Century. And in terms of the church, it was so shameful, my God. Was so bad. There were years in which we had two and even three popes, and all the time the rumor of poisoning and corruption was at the order of the day, and cardinals were appointed regardless of any Christian virtue and regardless of any merit. And it was in fighting all the time. It was shameful. Just pick any book teaching or speaking of that period in the church. It was really shameful. And then you have the 14th century. Wasn't good. Probably wasn't the worst one, but it wasn't good. Many factors were sort of combined to make things really nasty at that time. One of those factors was the plague, the bubonic plague that was spreading all over the place in Europe. We already mentioned this, and it was about a third of the population that was killed. So it was catastrophic, every bit of catastrophic. And people would say, this is the end of the world. And among them was a great Dominican preacher, you know his name, Saint Vincent Ferrer, who lived in this period. He was contemporary of Saint Catherine of Siena. And you can deduce how complicated things were because of the fact that Saint Vincent, being as he was a very holy man, he was supporting the anti-pope, because there was a schism in the Western Church. Schism, the big schism of the West. And that happened about 1377 or 78, I think. So it was during St. Catherine's lifetime. And that was probably one of the most terrible pains, wounds in her heart. The last period of her life was almost all the time interceding for the church and writing earnest letters to everybody she could think of so as to heal the schism in the church. So it was really, really bad. And part of the situation was that after all that massive destruction of the population, well, convents and priories and monasteries were the most affected, of course. You know, that's one of the things of common life, that you get infected very quickly. So people were dying. And in some cases, provinces of religious congregations were very concerned of just being swept away. They were concerned of disappearing. So, trying to fix the problem, they attempted a quick solution, and that was receiving lots of people. Very bad idea. Hopefully we never will repeat that mistake. They began accepting almost everybody and putting the habit in everyone that would say, hey, I probably would consider, yes, receive your habit. I was thinking of, yes, you are. So it was very bad for the church. That strategy never worked. And it happened among the diocesan priests, and it happened in religious communities. And you have to remember that this was the time in which priests were not formed in seminaries. Seminaries started with some decades after the Council of, how you say, Trento? Trent? Trent. Okay, well, it was some decades after the Council of Trent that it started over. So there were no seminaries. What was the usual formation of diocesan priests at that time? Well, again, shameful. Shameful. It was, my goodness, it was so bad. Because some of them, the little, close to nothing formation they received was just living with another priest. So you can imagine what kind of study, the level of study, some of them wouldn't be able to read properly the Latin language that was mandatory at that time. So they didn't even know what they were saying. They couldn't understand what they were doing. And canonical discipline had to be, after the Gregorian reform of the 11th century, canonical ecclesiastical discipline had to be stern and strict, but it wasn't. That was only on the paper. Reality was quite different. So many of these priests knew nothing about who they were, knew nothing about sacraments, knew nothing about their duties, and they knew a lot about their own interest. So they were very concerned about their lands, their cattle, their possessions, their wealth. And, well, one thing follows the other. They also wanted to have some families. So scandal was not the exception, was the rule. And in many cases, the priest would have some form, kind of a mass, some form of mass, and he would have his concubine or his lover or whatever in the congregation, and some of his children would be the serving to the altar, and everybody would know that. But some of them were, well, somehow concerned about their conscience, so they would go to the extreme of not consecrating. You remember at that time, Mass was celebrated in a very quiet voice, and it was, the priest was not visible. What he was doing was not visible to the people. Because of that, the arrangement of the church, of temples at that time, they were turning their backs on the assembly and facing the altar or facing the crucifix. So some priests would go to the extreme of not consecrating. So they would mumble some words, just deceiving the people behind them, and they never consecrated. And then they would distribute ordinary bread, because they were very concerned. But you can deduce from this how twisted and crooked was the whole thing. And they would distribute normal bread to the people. And the reason they acted that way was that they were concerned of consecrating, knowing very well, as they knew, that they were in a very, very bad state of soul. So they were trying to not commit a worse, to fall in a worse situation. And what they were doing was not consecrating, actually. I still have to hurt your ears with two or three other bad things of that time so that you can put St. Catherine's writings into context. Because I know that probably you have had, if you have tried to read the text itself, you have had the impression, what a language this lady is using. Because she's so harsh, and she insists in the damnation and condemnation of bad priests and all that. Well, you have to bear in mind this context to understand why she was using that kind of even rude language, writing to some cardinals, French cardinals, the ones that were involved in the election of the antipope, the pope that was backed by St. Vincent, by the way. It was a complicated time, very difficult. Well, St. Catherine, writing to these cardinals, she would use the most powerful, if you like, or insulting language that you can imagine. You know for sure that you are in mortal sin. That's the kind of language. And she was barely 26 or 27 at that time. So she was writing to the princes of the church, telling them very clearly, you know immortal sin. You know that you're deceiving the people. You know that you are betraying your ordination. That kind of language. But that kind of language we have to understand within this particular historical context. Well, the situation of some priests was really bad. I hope that not many people know about St. Catherine, because if they come to know, they will start making some movies and presenting in the cinemas. Did you know about the 14th century? I know that it is very, very serious and very sorrowful, very shameful, what has happened with many priests in our own time. But in my humble opinion, there is no comparison with what happened in this other century. Some of them would try to use the Eucharist as magic to attract the person they were in love. So that's the kind of thing. When you see that level of corruption, you can understand how much painful, how much hurtful had to be to St. Catherine's soul to come to appreciate the greatness of the Blessed Sacrament, to really esteem what is going on the altar, to come to love all that is happening every time we celebrate the Mass. Well, not everybody was corrupt, of course. There were a few very good priests, and some of them were actually friends with St. Catherine. Raymond of Capua, her confessor and spiritual director, was a very holy man, actually. He was very wise, very humble, very penitent. He was a good teacher. He was a good preacher. It was a general chapter. A general chapter of the friars who appointed him as spiritual director of St. Catherine. So I suppose St. Catherine was kind of making waves. She became a truly public person, so the general chapter of whatever date, I don't remember this exact year, appointed Blessed Raymond as a spiritual director, along with a couple of other friars that should be around. And she also would go to confession and to spiritual direction to two or three other priests. But people, regular people, ordinary people would say that it wasn't the case that Raymond was the spiritual director. The real spiritual director was St. Catherine. That was the people's opinion. That it was she who was actually guiding. But not because she would impose herself as such, but because of all these gifts of wisdom. I have to recognize with all sincerity and humbleness that now, as you know, by the grace of God, I have finished my doctorate here in this beautiful country. Ireland is the place who received me, that received me to make my doctorate, and I am about to receive my parchment. I cannot believe it. So I am doctor in theology now. Well, I suppose that means that I love to study, and that's true. It was difficult, it was a long endeavor, and since I began my acquaintance with St. Catherine, I never have ceased to admire all the wisdom that God granted her. I have to give testimony to this. Sometimes I could take just a paragraph of the dialogue and stay with that for a very long time, just picking all the teachings that are inside. Obviously, this is not just that she was very intelligent or she was very clever. This is the gift of wisdom. This is the gift of the Spirit, the gift of wisdom. So, in some cases, the scene would be very interesting with Raymond, because she would call Raymond to come over and to hear a confession, and this would happen very, very often. So she was of the same trend as Saint Dominic. You remember Dominic confessing almost every other day. So Saint Catherine was close to that. Unless absolutely necessary, please don't do this. Well, Saint Catherine would call Raymond to come over and to hear confession, and Raymond would give her some guidance, two or three phrases, the absolution, and then she would start, for example, making some praises to the Lord. And there are collections of St. Catherine's prayers. And they are beautiful. They are beautiful. And they have so much theology in that. One of the most famous, if you just want to pick one of them, please pick the one that was said in the day, in the feast of the Annunciation of the Lord. It's a meditation, it's kind of St. Catherine's Mariology. It is her theology of Mary, packed in a most beautiful prayer. So it was the case that when people took notice that she was saying this kind of language, just starting to say as normal chat, but she would start saying these beautiful prayers full of teaching, full of substance. So it was like a small group of people, I was to say a small gang, small group of people that would stay close to her, and they would take notice. They were writing down everything wise and beautiful that she would say. But they also confess that many, many prayers were lost. Anyway, so she would start saying some prayers, or she would start meditating aloud on some mystery, redemption, the blood of Christ, the Blessed Sacrament, or whatever. And once she had started, she knew no end. So it was complicated for poor Raymond. Because sometimes she would go after a very heavy and packed agenda. He would go to St. Catherine's place, and then hearing confession, and then she started again with all these beautiful meditations. But these beautiful meditations were endless. So after a while, the poor man would fall asleep. And she wouldn't take notice of that. She would continue in her profound dissertation about God's mercy and the angels and heaven and all that. And at some point she would open her eyes and she would realize that the man was completely, utterly out of his senses. Her only comment would be, "How much were you losing just for sleep?" And she wasn't arrogant in saying that, because she was the first person to be aware of the fact that what she was saying was just the gift of the Spirit. It wasn't fruit of her cleverness, her great intelligence, great erudition. No, she was just aware of the fact that the Holy Spirit used to work through her. So poor Raymond couldn't keep the pace with all this stream of wisdom and teaching. Which is why now we have these little devices. This is a recorder. So this would be life-saving for Raymond. He could put the recorder by the place and just record all of this beautiful wisdom. So now you have a clearer perspective of what was going on in that century. It was very bad in many aspects. What we have to bear in mind is that St. Catherine's love towards the Blessed Sacrament wasn't just devotion, wasn't just pious recollection, wasn't just piety. The Blessed Sacrament, and this is the central proposition of this talk, the Blessed Sacrament was access to redemption. That's the summary of the summary of St. Catherine's theology about the Eucharist. The Eucharist is important just because of one fact. And the one fact is, it is the presence of redemption among us. That is why the Eucharist is that important, because it is presence of God's redemption. It is God in the very act of redeeming us. It is God in the very act of saving us, rescuing us, or whatever synonym you prefer. So, coming to the Blessed Sacrament is not just having a spiritual time, in the poor sense of the word, is not just having some recollection or meditation. There is nothing to be compared with the Blessed Sacrament, because it is only in the Blessed Sacrament that we have the fullness of redemption just before our eyes, before our heart, before our own history, our own life. So, coming to the Blessed Sacrament is gaining access to the well of salvation. It is touching and being touched by the same God that did everything in our favor. In that sense, there is nothing to be compared with the Blessed Sacrament. Nothing. And this is also the context to understand that particular role that the term blood has in St. Catherine. Blood is a summary as well. Summary of what? It's the summary of the reality of Christ's sacrifice. Saint Ignatius of Antioch used to say that if Christ's suffering wasn't real, our salvation is not real either. It's not real. So it is the reality of Christ's sacrifice. It is the fact that his humanity suffered grievously to the extreme, and he gave up his everything for us. It is that act of giving up his everything that has brought salvation to each one of us. And how can we sum up that giving up his everything? Blood. So you have to take, please, you have to take the word blood as a summary of Christ giving up his everything for our salvation. Christ truly giving up his everything for our salvation. That's the meaning of blood. So it is not that she was keen of the cruelty. It is not masochism. It is not kind of morbid sense of cruelty. It is a theological perspective. So what she is admiring and what she is acknowledging and remembering whenever she uses the word blood is the true sacrifice of Christ, his true giving up everything, his everything for us. That's the meaning of blood. And that also means that this is the place to understand what does a priest mean for St. Catherine. For St. Catherine, the word priest, I suppose I should write a dictionary. For St. Catherine, priest stands for minister of Christ's blood. So why are we to appreciate and to be thankful and respectful and to pray for priests and all that recommendation that is so frequent in the church? Why are we to do so? Well, because they are ministers of the blood. And it is so wise, that language. Because that, if you think of it, it gives you the exact measure of affection, respect, and distance that is the proper relationship with a priest. It's exactly that. Full of appreciation, full of thankfulness, full of respect, and at the same time, full awareness of the particular role that the priest has. And it is not because he's a man, it is not because he's learned, it is not because he has power or authority, it is because he is the server, he is the minister of Christ's blood. Which means that we priests have to regard ourselves exactly in that same perspective. So all the dignity of the priest is not because I hold the authority here. I am the priest. No, it is because you have the permanent, irrevocable duty and right of distributing the bread of life and being minister of Christ's blood. There is a thought close to this one in the Office of Readings when you go to this bishop. It is the 4th of November, but I don't know his name in English as usual. Charles Borromeo. Well, he was a very holy man, and speaking to his priests, he would say, when you are serving the people, just be mindful of the blood that was shed for their sake. It is a very beautiful thought. And that is the true inspiration of priestly charity, of priestly holiness. So you can sort of deduce all the theology of priesthood just starting from the blood of Christ and understanding the blood of Christ in terms of the true sacrifice in which Christ gave up his everything for our salvation. So you see that there is a beautiful, grand structure. It can be compared to some architecture. This is the architecture of St. Catherine's theological thought. At the very center you have redemption, and then redemption is expressed in the sacrifice of blood, and that sacrifice is present in the Blessed Sacrament, and the ministers of that sacrament are priests, and what was earned with this sacrifice was the church. So this is also the origin of our loving the church. It all comes from redemption. That's the very central, that's the very, very central notion, concept, idea. That's the root also of everything else. So now we have some context to better situate and appreciate St. Catherine's teaching on the Blessed Sacrament. I hope that with her intercession, we become more and more true lovers of Christ's love in this Holy Sacrament. Glory be to the Father, and to the Son, and to the Holy Spirit.